Okay, so last time I sort of reviewed what all the string theories are and some of the dualities which relate them, and I stated the topics that I'm going to be focusing on, which have largely to do with the structure of the parameter spaces for these compactified string theories and the nature of various limit points. That you might find at the boundaries of these parameter spaces. So just to kind of review, we talked about some theories with 32 supercharges. And in the notation that Dan introduced this morning, these would involve Poincaré groups in 11 dimensions with 32 supercharges. I guess just to be consistent with what I was doing, I'll call it Poincaré in 1 plus 10 dimensions with 32 supercharges. That was the supersymmetry algebra, which was related to M-theory in 11 dimensions. Then there were two such algebras in 10 dimensions, and it's P1 plus 9, 32 comma 0. The chiral one, which is the 2B theory, and P1 plus 9, 16 comma 16, the non-chiral one, which is the 2A theory. And then we discussed last time P1 plus 8 slash 32. We compactified and found the relation between all three of these theories in 10 and 11 dimensions all coming together into one family when you got down to 9 dimensions, preserving the supersymmetry by compactifying on circles or, in the case of M theory, a 2 torus. And in just a few minutes, I'll extend this and tell you what the moduli spaces look like in the cases of these 32 supercharged theories all the way down the line. We also discussed already a little bit some of the theories with 16 supercharges. So again, just to make contact with Dan's notation, the minimal or the maximal dimension such theory is the 16 comma 0 theory in 9 plus 1 dimensions. And that was the one that was related to either the type 1 or the heterotic theories. And then we also discussed last time the reduction, one dimension down, theory in 8 plus 1 dimensions with 16 supercharges. Again, in a few more minutes, I'll be extending this sequence and telling you what happens when you compactify this class of theories, which by this time had gotten completely unified again, compactify this class of theories further on additional circles, which would not break any more of the supersymmetry so that we get this sequence of supersymmetry algebras. Okay, so these are names of string theory. So M theory is this quantum version of 11-dimensional supergravity that people are attempting to construct and which they have some reason to believe exists. And then there are 5 string theories in 10 dimensions. They're called type 1, type 2A, type 2B, and the heterotic theories with gauge groups E8 cross E8 and spin 32 mod Z2, whose Lie algebra is SO32, and that's the O, the source of the O in this notation. So these are the two heterotic theories. So I'm sort of approaching the subject from the opposite direction that Dan is, in some sense. As he mentioned already this morning, that he's kind of going to build up from theories with very small numbers of supercharges, supersymmetries, and discuss the structure and how it sort of gets more and more constrained as you go up. And I'm going to start up at the top where it's very constrained. And these extreme constraints which occur here have several effects. And one of them is that the possibilities for the parameter space are very highly constrained. So the way that comes about is that the first-order deformations of these theories can always be interpreted, it turns out, as fields within the theories themselves. As such, they must lie in representations of this very large superalgebra. And so you get a lot of control over geometric structures which live in the tangent spaces to these parameter spaces. And that's ultimately what's behind the classification that was worked out by people studying the supergravity theories themselves. So it's another one of these results that's really it's a result in super differential geometry. And a result which I believe is from approximately the late 70s, classifying what the parameter spaces are supposed to be. Now, the differential geometric analysis is only going to tell us what the universal cover of the parameter space is, and it's now believed, I mean, people believe they understand what the discrete subgroup is that you're supposed to mod out by, and you'll see that there's a kind of natural candidate for that discrete subgroup. And I don't want to spend too much time on this class of theories. I won't discuss that issue in too much detail, but I think the evidence is pretty good that we have the right group. Yes?
So in the field theory, I understand that the modulus is the tangent space for natural scalars in the theory at that point.
That's right.
So they definitely belong to the theory.
That's right.
So how do you describe in general when you're doing the string theories, if these families, what the tangent space is? You said they don't always belong to the theory.
No, I said they do belong to the theory.
You said in this case, but it seems to imply that they belong in another case. Well, anyway, how do you describe the tangent?
Depends what dimension we're talking about. I guess it's really in very low dimension that you have to worry about which of the fields are really tangent, are associated with first order deformations. Right. In sort of intermediate dimension, I think there aren't any, there isn't a distinction.
But in some parts of these moduli spaces where I have a good low energy field theory description,
right. Sure, so long as the dimension isn't too low. I think that's right.
Another point, I guess you don't have a good description. You take that point anyway, so it's hard to say. I'm not sure how I'm supposed to think of this parameter space you're trying to describe, so I'm just
going to... You have a little symmetry that the space of mass of the scalar is pretty much determined.
In this particular case, there's...
Right, well, the question, or the general one about the enterprise.
Right. I mean, in very low dimension, not all massless fields are moduli fields. And I think that was what prompted my comment. But I think that has to do more with the behavior of physics in very low dimension as opposed to a kind of intermediate dimension than any lack of understanding in, on your part about what I'm trying to say about the parameters. So... So I remind you that the way that we started to study these 32 supercharged theories was really by taking the 2A or the 2B theory and compactifying it on a torus. So let's, for definiteness, focus on 2A theory compactified on a torus of dimension K. And then, of course, I want, I'm always, I guess I should do a torus of dimension 9 minus D because I'm always trying to indicate that it's the effective theory that has d spatial dimensions in the notation. But just for simplicity, let's let k be 9 minus d so we don't get completely confused. And so the basic information which we need to describe the 2A theory, well, first of all, we need to describe the conformal field theory on the torus. So if we're looking at this perturbatively, the ingredients in the conformal field theory on the torus, the two-dimensional field theory is specified by specifying a metric, so we need a flat metric. And we also need a two-form, a harmonic two-form, which is only chosen modulo integer two-forms. So the reason for this, is, from the two-dimensional field theory point of view, is pretty clear. This is a kind of topological term in the action, and the action gets exponentiated in all physically reasonable quantities, and in Euclidean signature, the signs are such that you see that this has got to be periodic with respect to some basis of the integer two forms. So I can just write down the geometry, a geometric analysis of this data to describe a flat metric. On a torus, I really only need to describe a metric on one tangent space. And so the set of all possible metrics on RK is described by GLK mod OK, the stabilizer of the standard metric. Then I've got, in addition, this choice of harmonic 2 form, and again, I can simply choose the harmonic 2 form on the on the tangent space at one point, and then use parallel translation to produce a harmonic 2 form on the entire space. But the ambiguity in making this description, well, first of all, I've got wedge 2 zk, which is the reflection of this fact that I only want the harmonic 2 form to be well defined up to these translations. And then I also have to take into account the group of components of the diffeomorphism group of the torus, which acts, so when you were making the choice of trivialization, identifying the automorphism group of the tangent space with GLK, you could do that continuously within any connected component of the diffeomorphism group of the torus, but you still have to modify the action of the group of components, which is GLKZ. So this is a complete description of the geometric data that I specified here that's needed to write down the action for the two-dimensional sigma model on that torus, which is what we use to describe the conformal field theory. I do not want to do that.
So that would be wrong.
Well, it would globally be, you would make a small, that's right. Right, you would be leaving out the volume. So, right. So you could try to split off the volume and treat that separately, but you need the volume. So now this, in a rewriting that's very similar to something that happened in one of the examples we did in the first lecture, this turns out to be precisely isomorphic to OKK mod OK cross OK, modded out on the left by an integral parabolic subgroup, which, again, I'll just write as P sub Z, which is associated to a choice of maximal isotropic subspace inside of some lambda KK. So let me introduce lambda KK, which is a even unimodular lattice, a signature KK. And this parabolic that I'm describing here is associated with a maximal isotropic sublattice. The signature KK, I meant to say. Maximal isotropic sublattice. Subgroup of the integer group which fixes that. PH is the parabolic associated to this maximal isotropic subspace, and PZ is the intersection of that with the integer group. So this is what we would get from geometry, but now when you study T-duality carefully in this context, T-duality shows that the actual moduli space that you're supposed to get is not this thing modded out by the parabolic, but as you might expect, this thing modded out by the full arithmetic group. So this is what Marine did, this analysis. So this is the orthogonal group of that lattice, lambda KK, lambda KK. This is just a KAN decomposition for this group. This GL, this is, I guess I should write maybe the R, which is the one parameter abelian group that you get in there. This is locally, there's some finite group error cross SLK. That's the reductive part, rather the semi-simple part of the parabolic group. And then there's this other, this nilpotent part, which is coming up here. And you see that structure here in this group. Now, we're not finished because that was just the conformal field theory analysis, the analysis that comes from two dimensions. And it suppressed both the dilaton and the Ramon-Ramon sector. So you need to add a dilaton, which I'll take to be some R plus, and you need to add some Ramon-Ramon fields, which I'm just going to write as represented by V, which is a representation. Well, in the first instance of GLK, because it's built, as was explained this morning, out of either the, with not either. It's built out of the even cohomology of the torus, but actually, although it's not obvious, this collects together to form a representation of OKK. And I get a larger story when I try to describe the parameter space for the 2A theory on this torus TK, because now I have the OKK mod OK cross OK coming from the conformal field theory analysis. I have the R plus from the dilaton, and I have this representation of GLK V. Now, I should say that there's an underlying integer representation, which is the integer cohomology, and the Ramon-Ramon fields are periodic with respect to some version of integer cohomology. There's a slight complication in this part of the story about the periodicity, which I don't want to go into. But anyway, there's a periodicity on the Ramon-Ramon fields, which is known and understood. In addition, I had this this natural group, which was the orthogonal group of the lattice of signature K, comma K, acting on this space. So. Field strength. Pardon? So just as before, we're going to have a remarkable rewriting of this thing in the form G mod K mod an integral parabolic. And then the true answer, the actual moduli space, is going to be some group of the form G mod K mod gamma, where gamma is an arithmetic group, which is a natural integer form for this group G. But the extension is a little hard to get your hands on, and so I need to make a brief digression so that I can sort of tell you the combinatorics of this extension in a fairly compact way. So, by the way, I could think of this as either having been 2A now on, so K was 9 minus D, so it's either 2A on P 9 minus D cross R1D, or I could have thought of it as being M theory on T 10 minus D cross R1D. From this perspective, you see that there's actually supposed to be a somewhere in this story, there's supposed to be a GL 10 minus DZ acting, although you only saw the GL 9 minus Z part of it, 9 minus DZ part of it, showing up in this analysis here. It's buried in the O 9 minus D 9 minus D term here. There's a GL 9 minus D, but this GL 10 minus D is not part of this group. And this, in fact, the ability to act by the group of connected components of diffeomorphisms of the torus that you use to compactify M theory is what extends from this integer parabolic group up to this arithmetic group here that leads to the eventual moduli space. But we also need to do this identification. Which symmetric space is it that we're getting that describes the moduli space? So my little digression is for the benefit of algebraic geometers or people who might have seen this corner of algebraic geometry, because there's a very nice way of describing uniformly what all these groups are, although I do not claim that this this little side topic has anything to do at anything other than a combinatorial level with the answer to this question. It would be interesting if it did, but that's a thought that's been bugging me off and on for years without leading anywhere. So what are Del-Pezzo surfaces? So this is a classical problem in algebraic geometry. And the problem is classify, well, the first version of the problem is classify non-singular algebraic surfaces, that means two complex dimensions, in projective space, Pn, of degree n. So why did anybody ever pose this problem? Well, the minimum degree possible is n minus 1. And those are classifiable, and there's a very pretty description of what all the degree n minus 1 smooth non-singular algebraic surfaces in Pn are. It's pretty natural to ask about the next level up, the things of degree n, rather than degree n minus 1. There's a slight generalization of this in which I want to classify surfaces S with the property that we have an embedding. Well, it turns out that the linear system that you are studying on these surfaces is always the anti-canonical system. So you'd like minus KS to be ample, which means it's sufficiently positive that it has a possibility of giving an embedding. And you'd like the number of global sections, the dimension of the space of global sections of minus KS, to be n plus 1, so that the projectivization of that space was this Pn. And then you might have increased the number of examples that are allowed slightly. For example, I'm going to, in this way, include cases n equal 2 and n equal 1 will be allowed. That's really the only thing that this generalization has done for me, where there would not be any way of having a non-singular algebraic surface embedded into P2. It's forced to map multiple to 1 onto P2 just for dimension reasons. And similarly, the map to P1 has to have some fibers to it. Nevertheless, those are very natural members of this class with this slight generalization of the original projective geometry problem. So this is a problem. And now the answer, well, the solution to this problem is known. And the solution is that n has to be less than or equal to 9. And either S is the blow-up in 9 minus n points of P2. And you have to take points in general position. Or n equals 8, there's a sort of special case, and S is P1 cross P1. So in other words, for n equals 8, there are two possibilities. You can either have P1 cross P1, or you can have the blow up in one point, blow up one time of P2. So this is some old classical projective geometry problem, and this is the answer to it. Now, given such an S, you can consider consider a certain lattice, L sub S, which is going to be the set of elements in the integer cohomology which are perpendicular to this canonical class. So the natural class that we had was the canonical class, it's minus the canonical class that gave us the embedding into projective space, and this is some lattice. So I want to build a Lie algebra by using LS as the Cartan lattice. And I'll use the set of x's in LS such that x dot x is equal to minus 2 as the roots. There's a funny difference in sign conventions between algebraic geometry and Lie algebra theory, which leads me to end up having, in spite of your efforts in some paper about K3 20 years ago where you changed the sign of the intersection form here, the generally accepted sign in algebraic geometry has a minus 2 there instead of the more familiar 2. But anyway, just change the sign of the intersection form. This is a negative definite intersection matrix here so for anything that satisfies this problem. I can do this. So when I do this, I get, now let me tell you what I get for low values of n. So for n equal 1, the algebra that I get is E8. For n equal 2, the algebra I get is E7. For n equal 3, the algebra that I get is E6. And the algebras that I'm getting, let me start my table higher. So 1, 2, 3, I got E8, E7, and E6. For the next ones, I get some very natural extensions of the E series, sort of lopping off vertices from the Dinkin diagram from one end, right? If I start down at the long end of the E8 diagram and continue to lop off vertices, the next thing which I get is what you might have thought was was E5, which is really more familiarly known as D5. And then after that, it's A4. And then the one for N equals 6 is A1 cross A2. And then when N is 7, 8 and 9, and I really should sort of say 8 and 8 prime because there were two cases there, and 9, well, I get groups which are not necessarily semi-simple. So there may be an abelian factor. Those are cases in which the set of solutions to x dot x equal minus 2 does not span, not necessarily span the entire space. The 8 prime, it actually does. So the 8 prime is A1 again. But these other ones here, the 7, 8, and 9, are not reductive. This one's trivial. So there's nothing that happens there. Okay, so this is the Lie algebra. Well, this is a complex Lie algebra, and it's the complexification of the Lie algebra of capital G. That was, where is it? Capital G. So, what's remarkable, there are a number of remarkable things, but one of the remarkable things is that you got this bifurcation into two cases at precisely the same moment in these two classifications, right? You got two cases of degree 8 surfaces, and those exactly are the situation in which I have the 2A or 2B theories occurring over here. So let's just remind ourselves what the dimension is going to be when we compare. So now the comparison of the combinatorics is that when I was working with, say, M.
David, yeah.
The dots are things that I didn't want to write down. This one is U1. And this one is U1 cross SL2. It's not consistent with my notation. U1 cross A1 plus. There really should have been plus because it's algebra. Yeah. Yes.
For projective surfaces, are the Hilbert surfaces formally classifiable for direct?
Okay. So n. So the question is, what happens if I try to push n larger? And the answer is there are no surfaces that are non-singular once you get past that value of n. It's in distinction from the previous case where when you looked at the minimal degree surfaces, you could go up as high as you like. There's one special case at degree 5, in P5 of degree 4, there's a sort of unusual surface. But aside from that unusual guy, you can just go as high as you like. So it was a bit of a surprise, I think, to Del Pezzo and his contemporaries that this list stopped. Phrasing it in terms of the degree, I mean, as you're about to see, the dimension D that matches with this guy, so, let me finish making this dictionary. So I was working with M theory on T10 minus D cross R1D, and the chances of getting my D's and K's right the first time shouldn't be so hard. So D is the number of spatial dimensions in the remaining theory. So I have 10 spatial dimensions. D plus 1 is the total space-time dimension. That's 11. That's the one that corresponded to this maximal supergravity. 9, right, was a case where I had both 2A and 2B theories occurring. That was the 8 and the 8 prime. And then, so I guess D is N plus 1. That's the other way to say it. So 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2. So I can at least go down to two space dimensions, three space-time dimensions, in this way of describing things. Now, the construction of these algebras can be pushed further. I started out by saying that I really wanted to embed these surfaces someplace, but if I treat the surfaces a little bit more abstractly and think of them perhaps from this point of view now as being the blow-up at some number of points in general position, then I can repeat this construction, the difference being that although I have a finite rank lattice still, the lattice goes up by one dimension each time, the number of solutions to the x dot x equal minus 2 equation becomes infinite because this ceases to be a definite lattice, but a definite quadratic form, but rather becomes first semi-definite and then indefinite. So the natural ways to push it up are to things called E9 and E10, which would correspond to dimensions, spatial dimensions 1 and 0. And here you have a Katz-Moody algebra, and here you have some kind of hyperbolic algebra. And those seem to have something to do with the symmetries of these maximal supersymmetric theories in very low dimensions. So the analysis that tells you that it's really this kind of description is limited, I guess, to d bigger than or equal to 2. And stranger things happen to the physics down in d equal 1. Well, I guess this is a little related to your question, because when I get to, it's exactly when I get to d equal 1, Dan, that I start getting way too many massless fields. And on the other hand, I seem to have way too many. One plus one. I know. That's exactly where we're running into an interesting problem. Right. So this determined a complex algebra. Maybe GC was determined by this construction. And just to finish telling you what the story is, so there's a complex group GC. The group G is the so-called maximally split real form of GC. And then there's a natural arithmetic group associated to this problem, which is in fact generated by this GL 10 minus DZ and the other O lambda 9 minus D 9 minus D. Semi-direct whatever. It's really quite remarkable when you go through the list how this works out, right? The dimensions of these groups have a very strange property as you go along, and the dimensions of the symmetric spaces don't really obey any nice formula. But as it happens, you get different Ramon-Ramon fields coming into the spectrum at each level, and exactly the right number comes in at each moment to exactly make up the representation of this strange exceptional group that you need. So there's an amazing jigsaw puzzle that has to fit together here to make this story work, and it all works. So I think that's all I have to say about 32 supercharges. I did not bring my notes about that, but yes. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And sometimes there's an SL2R symmetry of the type 2B in 10 dimensions, and then if I dimensionally reduce, I also think the global rotation.
My SL, you can think of it that way too. My SL. The SL2Z of 2B is right here. That's the SL2Z of 2B. As you say, that shows up. I just described it as the additional symmetries coming from M-theory, but as we saw in 9 dimensions, you can think of it as coming from 2B or coming from M-theory. You're going to produce the extra group either way. So whatever the extra symmetry is that you need, you could think of as coming from either 2B or from M-theory. Okay, so on to the theories with 16 supercharges. These are a little less constrained, although they're still quite constrained, and their moduli spaces are still going to be described as essentially symmetric spaces, locally symmetric spaces. The easiest class of examples to discuss that I'll do first are the heterotic theories, well, the HE or HO or type 1 on a torus. So again, I'd like to formulate it with the torus as dimension 9 minus D cross effective theory in D plus 1 spacetime dimensions. And I'll mainly think of this as being the heterotic theory. And I discussed last time what happens up in the very highest dimensions, but by the time you get to 9 dimensions, these guys unify. So I need to slightly modify the previous analysis of the torus. Now I want to work with a torus TK, but also equipped with a bundle. And this is either an E8 cross E8 or a spin 32 mod Z2 bundle. And I think I'll come back and describe in more detail later some of the subtle points from a mathematical point of view of saying what it means to have these torus equipped with such a bundle. But what's going to happen, since I'm taking my original gauge theory and I'm wrapping it around various circles, what happens is that there's a gauge transformation associated with going around this circle. So I end up, if I choose a basis, choosing a basis of, say, H upper 1 or H lower 1 of TK with respect to Z, I end up with these so-called Wilson loops, which are going to be describing the group action. So these are supposed to be elements of the Cartan subgroup. I choose a Cartan subgroup, and they should be elements of the Cartan subgroup of the group G. So G is going to be E8 or spin 32 mod Z2. I can describe it equally well in either direction. And that's the additional geometric data, at least for generic points, that's the additional geometric data that I need to describe such a bundle in addition to the other data that I already had. So if you recall, the data that I had on the torus was a metric represented by GLK mod OK, and I had this B field, this 2 form, represented by wedge 2 RK, and now I've got to take the tensor product of this Cartan subalgebra, which I'll just call R16, with the RK, the tangent space or the cotangent space of the torus, and the periodicity here comes from the fact that I wanted elements of the Cartan subgroup, which I can think of as a kind of exponential of this R16. So I'm needing to mod out by Z16K times the previous stuff. So it's Z16K and also wedge 2 ZK, and that guy has to be semi-direct GLKZ. So that's the discrete subgroup that I end up with initially. Well, by the way, when we get beyond down below 16 supercharges, we stop getting these symmetric spaces and we stop being able to just write down KAN decompositions in parabolic subgroups. But here is another case. We're still in this nice situation where there is a KAN decomposition that's at work here and a parabolic subgroup. So this turns out to be precisely the same thing as OK, 16 plus K mod OK times O16 plus K, modulo an integer parabolic subgroup, again associated to a maximal isotropic subspace, where what's going on this time is... Yeah? CSG is Cartan subgroup. I don't know, CSA is maybe more familiar. So this time what's behind this is some, again, even unimodular lattice of signature 16 k, k comma 16 plus k, and this H is again a maximal isotropic sublattice. And there's an associated KAN decomposition, which looks exactly like this, and the integer parabolic subgroup acts on it in this way. And again, the T-duality analysis shows that the actual moduli space, when you include the T-duality, looks like the symmetric space modulo the natural maximal group O lambda K comma 16 plus K. Now, this time in going from the conformal field theory to the string theory, the only thing that I left out was the dilaton. So the actual HE or HO theory has as its parameter space the one that I just mentioned cross R plus for the dilaton again. And again, these are situations in which these are cases in which the supersymmetry is so constraining that there really isn't any room for any modification of this of the structure of this space, aside from possibly holes somewhere in the space. It's a little hard to know just from this analysis that at strong coupling, this space doesn't somehow develop problems at some places. That's not expected, but it's a little hard to rule out. At weak coupling, this analysis with the T-duality is on pretty firm footing, and there's no obstruction. Well, again, I had some discussion about generic bundles being determined by Wilson loops, and we have to come back to that point later on. But, I mean, that's something which physicists are very comfortable with, and mathematicians, it takes a little more work. In the end of the day, there's no difficulty with any of the points in this space.
Well, does supergravity allow rather more general stuff? For example, if you take B equals 4N or supergravity, I think you can have both fixed comma N.
You're quite right. Sorry. So what is supersymmetry? Supersymmetry. What I think I said was supersymmetry doesn't allow any corrections to this space. But it is certainly true that supersymmetry, in principle, will allow some spaces of the form OPQ mod OP cross OQ for other values of P and Q to show up in this context. Mod the appropriate, well, mod something, gamma. You don't really know. So that was one way of producing theories with 16 supercharges. But there are other ways of producing theories with 16 supercharges. Instead of compactifying our high-dimensional theory without breaking any supersymmetry, which has been the strategy up until this moment, we could try to compactify a higher-dimensional theory in a way that breaks part of the supersymmetry. So there are two ways to break half of the supersymmetry. One way is to introduce brains. We've seen in a lot of detail today how brains end up breaking half of the supersymmetry in problems like this. And the other way is to use K3 surfaces within the compact part of the space. And I described during the first lecture why the K3 surface with the Ricci flat metric on the K3 surface, which has in particular a covariantly constant spinner, why that would end up breaking only half of the supersymmetry, for example, when you reduce from 10 down to 6 or 11 down to 7. I'm going to do number two first, which is going to cause me to discuss the dimensions in an order not consistent with my plan of attack so far. And that's partly because models with brains included should be regarded as possibly a little more controversial in terms of whether they really exist, as opposed to models with where the compactification is actually on a compact space. Something funny happens at the brain, and you know, you really aren't including the actual brain itself, perhaps, in one way of interpreting what's happening. And so you're in this regime of possibly non-compact spaces with some kind of funny singularities in them, and it's a little harder to think about what it means. Whereas if I just try to proceed more geometrically and look at these K3 surface compactifications, then I might be happier. Now, as you'll see, there's good reason to believe that even when you study these things, you end up getting led to models in slightly higher dimension than what you started out with, where brains play an important role. So in some sense, part of this direction of argument will be, one of the points of this direction of argument will be to convince you that the models with brains are sensible things. So the first place where I can use K3 surfaces is to do an M-theory compactification on a K3 surface crossed with R16, producing a seven-dimensional effective field theory. And as I say, there are going to be some kind of analogs of this in 8 and even 9 dimensions, but it's best to approach those, or maybe not best, but I will approach those as limits of the M-theory compactified on K3. Now I remind you of the data that was required to specify such a compactification. The geometric data that I need will be a metric, in this case Ricci flat metric, on the K3 surface. I don't need the B field because I'm doing M theory instead of type 2A. I do in principle need a harmonic 3 form, but there aren't any. So I don't have to worry about that. And that's it. So the data for a compactified M-theory is going to be simply described by a choice of Ricci flat metric, period, on this K3 surface. Now, fortunately, we know what those are. And let me tell you the quickest way to describe, although it's not the quickest way to prove, what the space of Ricci flat metrics is. If you're given a Ricci flat metric, Gij, you can consider the decomposition of the space of harmonic 2 forms into plus and minus eigenspaces, the self-dual and the anti-self-dual forms. On the other hand, this is isomorphic to the cohomology of the manifold, and one can make a choice, the real cohomology of the manifold, one can make a choice of this as being isomorphic to some fixed lattice, lambda 319, which is isomorphic to the integer cohomology, tensored with the real numbers. So this isomorphism involves a choice of, this isomorphism in principle involves a choice of basis, and we have to worry about that choice of basis in just a moment. But having chosen that basis, I can always decompose, given the metric, this into these two subspaces. And then I could associate to Gij a point in, well, the space of let's see. I guess with my conventions, I've been using O1, N, so 1 must be time-like. So the space of totally time-like 3 planes in R319. So that's totally time-like 3 planes. And, that totally time-like 3 plane is the positive part in this description. So this is the R319 that I have in mind. I have some fixed R319. I'm using this isomorphism, which came from a choice of basis, to transport this choice of self-dual space and call it a totally time-like 3 plane. Now, because I made a choice of basis, again, the same argument from a few minutes ago where I had the torus, and I was worried about the choice of homology basis, and I said that, you could correct for a continuous variation, but you had to still mod out by the group of connected components of the diffeomorphism group. The same remark applies here. So what I really need to take is the totally time-like three planes in R319, but then I need to mod out by the component group of the diffeomorphisms of K3. So that's the natural place where this class of a metric goes. So I can sort of think of the metric as having defined a point in there. And the theorem is that the image of this map, so this is a one-to-one map, whose image is the complement of a subset of real codimension 3. And in fact, that subset of real codimension 3 is described as precisely the set of fixed points of the action of gamma. Let me call this guy gamma. So there's this group gamma acting on this space. It's got fixed points in real codimension 3. You remove those fixed points, and you get the set of all possible Ricci flat metrics on a K3 surface. Fixed points of reflections, but I think, well, let me just say fixed points of reflections. That's right. That's right. So of fixed points of certain reflections R sub sigma in gamma, which are reflections in element sigma. Sigma dot sigma equals minus 2, where sigma is an element of this lambda 319. Now, there's a more explicit way of describing this space. I can describe this space in terms of the symmetries that it has, which is O319. It's almost O319, except I have to take an index 2 subgroup of O319. I neglected to say what plus meant. Oriented, totally time-like three planes. I had to choose. I get an orientation on this space from the metric. So I look at the class in oriented time-like three planes, and then the stabilizer of a, I don't know, from the L2 norm on H2. No. You're quite right. That's not the orientation. Hang on. I have to choose. There are two connected components to time-like three planes, and the metrics lie in one of them. And that's, well, K3 should be oriented. I know. I'm just trying to think of an invariant way to say that, because I haven't used complex structures at all, if you noticed. But that reverses the orientation of a K3. So if I... Oh, that's true. No. That doesn't preserve the Ricci flat metric. Oh, on a real structure it does, I guess. Uh, let me not do this. I think that's right. I think I don't want to try to orient this thing. So this is O319 mod O3 cross O19. Module of this group. Now, as it happens, the group of components of the diffeomorphism group of a K3 is an index 2 subgroup of the maximal arithmetic group here. So this is what I was trying to account for. But it is nevertheless true that this space can also, this same space can also be described as O plus 319 mod SO3 cross O19, where O plus actually means the pair of connected components whose corresponding connected components in this stabilizer is this. And I didn't change the space by describing it this way. So it's a little more obvious that it's connected when I write it this way, but it's the same space either way. SO3 cross O19.
And on the last factor, you have O oriented 3 planes.
On the last factor, I've oriented 3 planes. Yeah, this one. The one. Pardon? Yes, for the discrete group, I'm telling you it's O plus 319 intersected with O lambda 319. And the definition of this is it's the two components whose intersection with that O3 cross O19 is this. So, right, I mean, it's a consequence of one of Donaldson's early theorems that you're restricted to this index 2 subgroup. And then somehow through either a direct description of the topology or as a consequence of the whole Torelli business, you can show that the group is filled out. So this is the set of metrics. Except for this business about the removing some subset of real codimension 3, this is a good description of all the metrics on K3 surfaces. And therefore, it's a description, at least in a place where the supergravity is a good approximation, such as for large. Oh, and I forgot the volume. The entire point is I also have to.